Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, titled, The Impact of RTCA DO17AC and New Trends in Software Specification and What It Means to You. My name is John McHale, Editorial Director of Military Embedded Systems Magazine and moderator for today's event. Today's speakers are George Romanski, Chief Executive Officer at Vericel, and Joe Vallette, Senior Director for Wind River Systems. The event sponsors are Vericel and Wind River Systems. The eCast will consume about 35 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. Before we get going, though, I want to point out some important buttons on your console. First, take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you will be able to view the slides in full screen mode. Please note that the speakers will also be not have access to, when the demos start, the second important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to send an email of request for this event. And lastly, you'll find on your console window a button that allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand out the questions equally to our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we would like to, we may not be able to get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be posted online today, and an audio podcast will also be available. Now, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker and a real expert on DO17AC, George Romanski of Vericel. George?
Thank you, John. I'll be talking about certification with DO17AC. Initially, I'd just like to give you a very brief introduction to Vericel, the company. We were members of the SC205, so we did help write DO17AC for 7 years. We are members of the UCSWG, Unmanned Air Systems Control Segment Working Group. We continue to be members of ARINC 653. There's a meeting going on this very week. And what we do are we provide verification services, we provide verification tools, also development services and tools. We sell or produce specific tools that we use, but all aimed at safety-critical systems. And we do offer DO-178B training with DO-178C training coming in due course. So the presentation will focus on DO-178C and where it fits into your development and verification process, basically what the main changes are to the core document. We can't describe the complete document, but what this presentation is giving is an introduction onto the actual changes itself. And there'll be some information about the new supplements, and hopefully what you'll get out of it is what sort of effect this will have on you when you start doing certifications. I'd like to start out by identifying where DO-17AC fits into the general process, basically the relationship between the avionic standards. So we always start off a certification with an assessment of the safety requirements. So we have intended aircraft functions feeding the safety assessment process. That feeds into a process for developing the system. The safety assessment is driven by ARP 4761, which is an SAE document, and ARP 4754A is a document used to develop and verify a specific system. And, of course, output from this drives the hardware and the software development process, mainly by selecting requirements allocated to hardware, requirements allocated to software, which now feed into the develop hardware process and the develop software process. And the develop software process is now governed by DO-17AC and for avionic systems, and DO-278A for airborne systems. when we look at the interactions between these specific standards, we have the requirement allocated to software and hardware feeding into the developed complex hardware, electronic hardware process are governed by DO254, and of course the requirements going in to the developed software. As we develop the software, we do get some feedback, and that feedback goes back into the safety assessment process. That feedback is usually what we call a derived requirement. Any new requirements produced during our software development process which are beyond those requirements which were introduced to us by the system development process, these derived requirements are now fed back in to the system safety assessment process. Now, there was no... In DO178B, we had exactly the same process, and we had this derived requirement mechanism which fed back into the system safety assessment process. In DO178B, this has been clarified, and it's much clearer what the interaction is between the software development process and the system safety assessment process. There was a lot of interaction between the committees writing this DO of 4754. There was a coordination between this new 4754 and the new DO178C so that we would describe exactly how these derived requirements should be handled. So this is a main layout of the documents. In actual fact, DO178C isn't just one document. Well, it is one document in its own right, but the committee producing this document actually produced seven documents. So the first one was DO178C, which was just an update of DO178B, and then we revised DO278 to make it DO278A. DO248C was written, it was extended from DO178B before, and it is now called Supporting Information. It used to be called clarification, but hopefully the new document is clearer, so we don't need any more clarification. That's why it's called supporting information. DO330 is a new document called Software Tool Qualification Considerations. Previously, we only had seven pages which described what the activities required or the objectives for tool qualification. This has now been extended. It's somewhere around a 70-page document now, which describes in much more detail what needs to be done to qualify tools. We have three supplemental documents. We have one for model-based development and verification, one for object-oriented, and one for formal methods. These are new additional documents so that if you develop software using object-oriented technologies, then you would invoke DO332 as well as the DO178C. And I'll be describing those documents a little bit further on. So let's look at the main changes in DO178C. When it was first written, the document was technology neutral. It is still technology neutral. The document doesn't specify what the processes should be. It doesn't specify how you should develop. It doesn't describe a waterfall model or an agile development model or any other technique. That is left up to the developer or the applicant. What we have is a technology neutral document where technology supplements can now be added. So we've had three new ones, but the expectation is that in the future, if a new technology supplement is required, it can be added without having to update the core document. The changes to the document were deliberately and very conservative. Even the section numbers were preserved as much as possible. A few sections were added, but by and large, the numbers were the same. Many people have said that we already have plans and standards in our company that describe how to use how to develop software and verify software. We don't want to throw those plans away and rewrite them just because the section numbers have changed. So by and large, the section numbers were kept. The intent of the document is still maintained, but clearly we wanted to improve the document and resolve any ambiguities that were there. It continues to be objective-based. So previously the document was based on objectives. It is still objective-based, even though activities are described well in the document. There are many subtle changes, and the changes may be subtle or not subtle. It really depends on your point of view. The whole document was produced by consensus. There was at any one meeting, there was between 100 and 150 people show up at the meeting, and basically we ended up with a voting process which said, well, can you live with the document as is to build up consensus? So clearly the document did have some compromises. The document is requirement-based, and we start off with having system requirements as defined by ARP 4754A, which now thread through to system requirements allocated to software. These are now handed over to the software development process. These are now then factored into high-level requirements, and then they are refined gradually until we have some low-level requirements. We have DO178B objectives for high-level requirements and low-level requirements. However, the document does allow there to be intermediate levels of requirements, and you can consider them to be higher-level requirements or lower-level requirements. It depends which way you look up or down, which way you decompose. Essentially, high-level requirements are the kind of the black box requirements. They're what the system should appear like. That's the intended behavior as viewed from outside. The low-level requirements are usually influenced by the design decisions, and they end up being low enough that you can write source code from them. And clearly, those low-level requirements are then eventually decomposed into software. Traceability has always been required. So we do expect traceability between the system requirements, high-level requirements, low-level requirements, and source code. In addition, we need traceability between high-level requirements and test specifications and the test procedures, test results, coverage analysis, and so on. There's also a link between coverage analysis and source code. One of my arrows is just missing. The key thing that is different in DO178B, or let's say it's much more explicit now, is that traceability needs to be bidirectional. So you need to be able to trace from source code to low-level requirements and back. You need to be able to trace from test procedures to source code and back. It was implied before. Now it's much more explicit. We don't mind how the traceability is done. It could use naming conventions, hyperlinking, etc. At Vericel, we tend to use all three. But traceability is definitely a requirement. We need requirement-based test cases. There was an implication that the requirements were, sorry, tests were always requirement-based. However, it is now very explicit that requirements have to be, test cases have to be requirement-based. When we look at test cases, I don't like the definition. Unfortunately, I missed it during the voting process, where the test cases are said to exercise a particular program path or to verify compliance with specific requirements. I think that should have been an and. We missed it. The requirements are definitely, the tests are definitely requirement-based now. So even when we have robustness coverage, robustness tests have to be requirement-based. It was ambiguous before, and we've been in situations where auditors try to make us write robustness test cases not against requirements, but against code, and clearly that is wrong. And the attitude that people may have had in the past where they said, well, let's run the high-level test and see what's missing, and then you run write some more tests just to obtain coverage, that should be rejected by the auditors. You can't just do that. You have to write more requirements before you write more tests. We require independence between development and verification objectives or activities. The D178B and C documents specify in the back of the document which activities have to be performed with independence. Now, in the past, this has always been on the verification side. In other words, if someone has written a test, you need someone different to review that test. You need that sort of independence. We have the same objectives and activities with D178C. However, there is one new objective, and that's in the development. On the development side, it is now a requirement that low-level test cases be developed by someone who did not write the source code. In other words, the source code developer cannot develop test cases, and the person who wrote the test cases cannot write the source code. This is different in D178C. I should say that there were some people that wanted even more independence, but the committee decided that this level of independence for the development cycle was sufficient. Data and control coupling was added very late in the D178B document. It was revised in D178C. Its intent is the same, and the intent of data and control coupling is to show the goodness of the integration process. So, we have requirement-based tests, and if people test unit by unit, then when they integrate the system, we need to have a measure that this integration is still valid, it's still robust. Now, some people say, well, we will do integration testing. But integration testing on its own doesn't provide you enough coverage. It doesn't give you enough information to be able to assess that all of the data items that connect between different functions in the system, they are actually connected properly, and that the functions themselves are resolved properly by the linker. So the data and control coupling objective is now explicitly, it's a verification objective done by test. So you need a set of tests to make sure that all the data coupling between units that are separately compiled, they have been exercised, and that all of the functions which are resolved by the linker have been properly exercised. Now, this may be quite a substantial change for some people. If you've only done unit-level testing and then just do integration-level tests, then you need to define or improve your process for data and control coupling. At Vericel, we have a different approach in that we always just test the integrated image without instrumenting it. And we also use that same mechanism for coverage measurement. So as long as we have tests that verify the data coupling and the control coupling, and then we use this in an integrated image, then we take credit for our regular requirement-based testing and coverage analysis. We take credit for that to achieve data and control coupling. If you don't do that, then you have to be careful, very careful, how you address data and control coupling in the future. There is a requirement for level A software, there is a requirement to show traceability between source and object code. Now, this has always been there, but it was never explicitly mentioned as an objective itself. So what happens in D178C now, there is an explicit requirement which says that you have to show source-to-object traceability. Now, what does this mean? It really means that the relationship between the source code and the object code has to be analyzed or verified such that we know that all the code that may have been inadvertently inserted by the compiler, that has been analyzed and verified. So the example given in the D178C book is where a compiler inserts a boundary check of some sort. So if your language says the compiler should insert a boundary check to make sure this boundary is safe before it's used, is in range before it's used, then this is additional code inserted by the compiler for level A software. This has to be identified and it has to be verified to make sure that this is correct. Now, there is some discussion because the compiler writers claim that this additional code, well, we expect it. You know, as compiler developers, they expect this code. This is what the compiler inserts. Therefore, all is well and good. The application developers may not know what the compiler has inserted, so there may be some problems with that inserted code. For level A code, we have to make sure that that inserted code has been verified. So it depends on your approach. It depends on your how you resolve these things. But we can't just assume the compiler has inserted the code correctly. Parameter data items have new meaning, or there's some additional objectives. Parameter data items are data items which are inserted into the loaded image to configure something, to configure the code to behave in a certain way. And clearly, this data can have a big effect on the safety of the software. So this data has to be checked. And this data, it's quite hard to verify this. If you look at code, then with code we can have equivalence classes. And if you change check a piece of code to be in the range 0 to 10, then you don't have to check it for 2, 3, 4, and 5 and all the values in between, because we can claim this is an equivalence class. With a data value, we don't have equivalence classes, and it may be that every data item has to be verified in a configuration table. Now, these configuration tables are becoming extremely important. They can become quite large, especially when you're configuring IMA systems. So you do need a special approach to make sure that parameter data items, things like configuration tables, are verified to make sure that every value is actually correct. DO248C is now supporting information. Basically, we had frequently asked questions and discussion papers, which provided clarification. Well, we still have frequently asked questions and discussion papers in DO248C. It's now, as I said before, it's now called ancillary information. There is also some additional information where the document includes some rationale. So there's been some rationale added by the developers of D178C to describe why certain things were done in various in certain ways. And this rationale is really quite useful. DO330, and as an aside, I should point out, where I have DO330, and I have ED215. The ED215 is the UOK number for the RTCA DO330 document. These are exactly the same documents. They just have a different numbering scheme in UOK and RTCA. So DO330 provides tool qualification considerations. So now as we develop tools and the tools have to be qualified, we do have to now describe the purpose, planning process, various integral processes, provide tool qualification data, etc. We now have different, or we have more qualification levels. In the past, we only had two. We had development tools and verification tools. We now have three different criteria, and we have four different software levels. And depending on the criteria, this table indicates to you what the tool qualification level is, and this tool qualification level is then used in the objective matrix at the back of this document to identify which objectives have to be satisfied to make sure that this tool is qualified. Model-based development is, it could be the most, it's a supplement that might make the biggest change. We see a huge number of, or huge migration towards development of avionics software using models, and model-based supplement provides guidance. So there are many advantages to using models for safety-critical software. However, as the guidance points out, there must always be requirements from which models are developed. And we now have to qualify this and actually specify if a model is a design model or a specification model, but a model can't be both. What we've had in the past is that some applicants might develop a model and they say, hey, this model specifies my requirements. You know, it may include use cases and all sorts of other mechanisms, and they say, hey, this specifies my requirements. And then they say, oh, by the way, this model also captures my design. Oh, and by the way, this model can also be used to automatically generate code. And clearly what we can't have is the same model representing the intended behavior and the actual implementation. We need a separation so we can check one against the other. So you need to now specify if the model is a specification model or a design model. It is possible to use model simulation to obtain some certification credit. Testing is still required. But it may be that certain objectives can quite easily be satisfied using model simulation. For example, if you have a transition diagram, the transition matrices or transition diagrams could be quite easily verified on the model, and they have a direct correspondence to the source code. So we can take some credit for doing some of this analysis on the model. However, if your model simulator is running on an Intel machine and your final application is running on, a PowerPC, then the floating point implementations may be quite different. And you can't take credit for many, you have to test on the target machine if you want to take credit for the verification on the target. There is some certification credit may be given for tools if the tool uses a qualified code generator. You have to be very careful how much credit you can take, because qualified generators, let's say that some people make bigger claims than they should. Formal methods, the D178C has permitted the use of formal methods in the past. But it was only done sort of like an auxiliary, and it's also permitted. It's much more explicit now in D178C if you want to use formal methods. There are many advantages of using formal methods. You can reason about certain behaviors much more precisely using a formal method. Some faults may be quite difficult to find by test, whereas a formal method may find these things. For example, many years ago, I used a formal method to try and verify a piece of software just for fun to see if this formal method could find a deadlock situation in the dining philosopher's problem. And I was quite pleased to find that the formal method not only found the deadlock, but it also explained under which conditions the deadlock would occur. You have to be careful how much credit you do take. So the formal method mechanisms or the formal method team specify, you know, did say that you have to use tests as well as formal methods. You can't do one in the exclusion of the others. But certain faults, as I say, can be quite easily found. And tools like the Spark Examiner, for example, will show through analysis the absence of certain exceptions being raised. And I think that's much more powerful than trying to devise tests to see if we can find all of these situations by test. Object-oriented technology also includes AND related techniques. So there's been quite an increase in the use of C++ in our experience. And what we find is that C++ code, or people using formal methods, do find that the code is quite a bit smaller. We've seen reductions of about 40%. However, we do see that the testing obligations are still quite high, or much higher than just with regular C. And this supplement now asks for people to resolve things like dynamic memory management, and virtualization techniques has been added. So if you use virtualization techniques, even if you don't use D0178C, this supplement will still apply. So when we look back at D178C, the most significant changes, there were a lot of changes between the actual improving the text. We have a lot of new information about guidelines and guidance. That's just been cleaned up. The objectives and activities, you know, activities are not mandatory, objectives are mandatory. There's been a lot of changes, but those are still pretty similar to what the objectives and activities were in D178B. The higher and lower level requirements, we had those before, it's much clearer now. Requirement-based testing, this has been extended. We do have some requirements expressed by logic equations. Now we have to do this testing even at level C. Robustness testing is requirement-based. MCDC is much cleaner, it's much better explained, and we now do have unique cause MCDC, masking MCDC, and also short circuit forms. This is well explained in DO248 with discussion with the DO248C with a discussion paper. Better definitions and explanations of deactivated code. So will the changes affect you? Well, if you process plans and standards interpreted D178B the way it was intended, then there's very little effect. If your interpretations were different, then of course you may have more work to do. So data and control coupling is something that sticks out. Robustness testing based on source code, that sticks out. That will need to be changed. Logic-based requirements, if it's not fully covered by your requirement tests, then that will be extra work for you. So these changes may force you to update your plans and standards and may cause you to revise any work that you've done in the past if you're trying to take credit with D178C. That concludes my presentation. I'd like now to hand over to Joe. Joe Vlad, would you like to take over, please?
Thank you, George. Folks, I'll have a few more words to say about DO-178C, and then I'll get into a discussion on what's beyond DO-178C, use of multi-core technologies in software and hardware systems. The first thing I want to talk about is when will customers and vendors and operators need to apply DO-178C? You heard George talk about the nuances of DO-178C and how there could be some unique and subtle areas that are different from DO-178B. And first of all, the documents have all been released and published. I'm not quite certain all the parallel documents have been released in Europe. I believe they have. Nevertheless, when should you apply DO-178C? Well, as of March 2012, the FAA has yet to release a revision to Advisory Circular 20-115 recognizing DO-178C as a recommended means to certify software. AC 20-115 Revision B recognized DO-178B as an acceptable means to secure FAA approval of software use. So typically, we'd expect the FAA to come forward with a release of AC 20-115 that would recognize DO-178C. So until that's done, the formalities of applying DO-178B or DO-178C aren't going to be realized. However, that doesn't prohibit you from embracing it now. There may be many of you participating in either supplemental type certificate activities or type certificate activities for aircraft, or even developing technical standard order appliances. An example here is TSO C-146, which applies to GPS wide area augmentation system receivers. Typically, those TSOs call out DO-178B as a recommended means for approving software, and they also call out typically the software level that would be applied, and in TSO C-146, it would be level B. So until those TSOs are revised along with AC 2115, I would not expect that the DO-178C becoming a hard requirement. In fact, there are probably developers out there today who have legacy systems that apply to DO-178A processes instead of DO-178B. So the evolution will actually take some time. This will not be an instantaneous transition, and it will mean some adoption. So if we just look at the technical standard order process, if you're building an appliance, an air data computer, a display system, or a GPS inertial navigation unit, you may be doing this under technical standard order, which it gives you both a design and production approvals. And so if you want to embrace DO-178C, you in fact could write your plan for software aspects of certification to your local certification office, recognizing or wanting to use DO-178C as a means of compliance. If, for example, you're making minor changes to an existing product that you have under TSO, you can likely still apply DO-178B processes as long as the TSO calls out DO-178B as the recommended means. Now, there may be a time in the future where you have discussions with an ACO or your certification authority where you might be using some of the parallel technologies called out in DO-178C. Maybe you're using model-based development. Maybe you're using object-oriented technologies. Or maybe you're making sophisticated use of either verification or development tools. The FAA may come back and say, well, we think you really should, or try to coach you into using DO-178C. So I would suggest that you have discussions with your local certification office and then try to work in a transition plan that would allow you to migrate some of your existing processes from DO-178B to DO-178C. So with that, I'll close on the DO-178C discussion, and now let's talk about multi-core certification. And this isn't really relevant directly to DO-178C. However, as you're making these migrations into a new version of the standard, it's very appropriate to talk about some of the migrations of new technology that also impact the way software is certified. And at Wind River here, we're seeing many of our customers transition to single-core silicon and now adopting multi-core silicon for use in safety-critical systems. So I have here just a definition of what is multi-core and why is it important. Well, multi-core is an architecture where you can compose more than one physical processor onto a single piece of silicon that would be packaged into a die. And why would people want to do that? Well, multi-core enables the system to perform more tasks and resulting in greater performance for your applications. But there is more complexity involved in design. And certainly there's more complexity involved in the certification process. So why even bother adopting a multi-core strategy or a multi-core development process? Well, first of all, in the future, there may not be a choice. Here at Wind River, our customers are doing this a lot. They're embracing the future. They need to be able to have more throughput capacity with the processors they're using and want to use in the future. There is rather a pervasive availability of multi-core silicon today, both from Freescale and Intel and ARM and other semiconductor manufacturers. And there's also a growing interest in multi-version operating systems and virtualization, being able to consolidate legacy software onto new silicon that embraces or cooperates with revised software or new software. So, for example, you could be building something on Linux or even Windows applications, which have in some cases been certified to DO178 Level C, and adopt those on new platforms where you may run Level B or even Level A applications. So that will become a very challenging effort for certification to adopt these types of heterogeneous systems and addressing the certification considerations. So some of the obstacles that will prevent people from adopting multi-core is that the design of applications have to happen in parallel. There aren't necessarily a lot of experienced developers out there. There may be some time-to-market issues with adopting multi-core silicon. And in order to train your team of developers and designers, you need maybe to invest first in some research and development that will help you climb that learning curve to use multi-core silicon. And then the key questions we're getting from our customers is, well, how do we apply use of multi-core and our applications to address future security and safety requirements? And this applies not only to the aerospace, commercial, and defense markets, but also industrial applications and medical applications as well. So here's just one use case where there are two ways really to model multi-core silicon, the first way being asymmetric multiprocessing, where essentially we have one core handling one application and these applications communicating across a backplane of some sort, so we can kind of easily decompose all the applications, old and new, divide them up among the cores, and then kind of have these things loosely partitioned. But the good part is that's probably an easier design methodology to kind of have these loosely coupled nodes that communicate across the backplane. But typically, you'd have to have those certified all to a common level of DO178C. It would be hard to partition a system like this because of the communication paths and, of course, orchestrating the parallel applications together and making sure that there wasn't any cross-coupling between them could impact certification. So another way to do it, of course, is to do symmetric multiprocessing where we have an operating system that kind of manages the cores and the applications on those cores and the resources those cores use. And again, the same partitioning considerations would come into play here, but it's a little bit, maybe it's a little bit easier to address because you have a system that can kind of be segregated and separated by this real-time operating system. So when we addressed partitioning before under DO178B and these integrated modular avionics platforms, we had addressed three areas of partitioning: spatial, time, and resource partitioning. Spatial partitioning meaning that each application had its own dedicated memory spaces and that they couldn't impact each other. And then in time, those things could allocate on a single core system, get use of the operating system resources and not have those perturbed by any other application or the operating system itself. And if they wanted to share memory or share devices, input and output devices, that those resources could be divided and allocated properly without causing corruption between one or more applications. So in the IMA world, we had to divide and certify these things in a partitioned environment and had to have requirements for spatial, time, and resource partitioning. So that's the way we handled it under the single core environments. Now, for the multi-core environments, we have more shared resources to worry about. And in this picture, there's a lot of information here, but I have the areas of contention circled, and those areas are, of course, backplane buses and cache and memory areas that could be common to the operating system environment and might be common to the applications. And so there's another area where we have to look at those shared resources. These are resources that will be used in these multi-core designs, where we have to get into the fabric of the silicon to determine how those things could be divided properly. And so these are the challenges for certification for application developers embracing not only DO178C, but also embracing multi-core design methodologies. So I just want to kind of lay this background for you. As you're adopting DO178C, you may also have to address the challenges of a multi-core environment where you get into new partitioning considerations that have yet to be addressed. There are really no formal policies written for certification of multi-core systems, so this is a new frontier for all of us as developers and vendors alike. So some of the obstacles, of course, is that there's really no certification guidance today for doing these multi-core systems at different levels of DO178 criticality. There are different ways to implement multi-core. As you saw, there might be asymmetric multi-processing designs or symmetric multi-processing designs. We have shared caches, shared bus contention, exception handling that could impact one or more applications, the ability to manage time. So all the partitioning obstacles we had to overcome in single-core designs have to be overcome in these multi-core designs as well. So what we have to do as a community of developers and certification authorities is that while our community is starting to adopt multi-core systems, they need to really start to consider about how we address the certification policies and considerations. And I think that's going to really require a lot of collaboration between the vendors, application developers, and the certification authorities and government and industry, and also the semiconductors that will have to define the desired architectural properties of systems that may be built on multi-core, whether it's asymmetric, symmetric, or even using an Airing 653 type of model of IMA. And then we have to define and expose the details of the silicon architectures to help identify more of these partitioning considerations. There may be working groups formulated around this that were similar to the creation of the DO178C. And then, of course, we need to make available to the community software and tools to help build and certify these systems. And, of course, we need the government certification authorities to be involved in this process as well. But I think this is an upcoming thing that we'll look forward to in the future. So as you're beginning to embrace DO178C, certainly we want to have you thinking about how to adopt and use DO178C in the context of multi-core systems. And with that, John, I'll turn that back over to you. I know we have many questions, so we're happy to participate in answering those.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for the excellent talk, and also thank you to George as well. Without any further ado, let's just turn it right over to the questions and get started there. First question I have from the audience is MC-DC testing still a required needed component for Level A certification? Anyone?
Yes, absolutely. So I'd like to restate the question. MC-DC testing is not allowed. It never has been. It should not be used. MC-DC coverage analysis is a coverage analysis obligation that is required for Level A. So we have to use the same requirement-based tests that we did to verify the functionality of the system, and we measure MC-DC coverage for Level A code, using those same requirement-based tests.
Thanks, George. Next question. Have you seen any movement where hardware such as FPGAs are required to follow D178 rather than DO254? If so, what was it or is the biggest issue to address here?
Well, I'll give you my perspective on this, John. This is Joe and the audience. I haven't yet seen a move to migrate away from DO254. I know there has been some discussion about trying to revise DO254 to be more commensurate with the requirements of DO178C, but I know those discussions have just been taken place initially, and maybe, George, you've heard more about those discussions in the SC205 committee you've been involved in.
No, so DO254 still stands. There has been discussion on to update it, just as we updated DO178B. But right now, DO254 stands. The biggest difference, to my mind, looking at DO254 and 178B, is that the code is kind of different. You know, it appears the same. It appears kind of structured, ADA-like syntax, but the biggest difference with VHDL and Verilog is that it executes in parallel, and you need to verify it differently. You can verify it with simulators, but you need to think about the code differently than you would with regular code. So I couldn't see DO178B being applied, or DO178B objectives being applied directly to DO254. Having said that, whenever we did DO254, we used our existing DO178B tools and processes as much as we possibly could, even though the verification techniques were different at the end of the day.
Thanks, George. Good question here. The person who wrote the source code can execute the test case?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, There's no independence obligation, specific independence obligation on the execution of the test. It's the person who writes the test specification has to be different from the person who wrote the test code. How the tests can be written by either of those two people, and a test can be run by either of those two people. Now, as a process, you might prefer to have independence, perhaps with QA watching the final test run. But there's no absolute requirement for that.
Yeah, and most of the folks today, when they actually execute tests, are actually doing them more in an automated fashion. So the actual execution portion is taking place by an environment instead of an engineer or an SQA or SQE.
Okay. Thanks, Shulman. Next question. Is the new requirement for development independence, otherwise, developer can't be the unit level tester for all levels of DO178C, in particular level C?
No, for the tester itself, you don't need independence to be the tester. Perhaps I should explain a little bit about what I did mention level C being slightly different. What I meant there was, if you write a requirement which is based on a logic equation, for example, if you said switch lights on, lights shall be switched on when the nose landing gear and left landing gear and right landing gear are all on or down, you see, now you've expressed that requirement more or less like a logic equation. You're saying this if condition A and condition B and condition C. And to verify that requirement, you have to show that every one of those conditions independently affects that equation. And that equation is stated in the requirement, so you need the same number of tests that you would as if it was written as an MCDC equation, implemented with a MCDC code. And this was a surprise to some people, actually it was a surprise to me, that for level C, we may have the same number of tests as we would for level A if you've written your requirement as a logic equation. And that's a clarification in DO178C, which I think might surprise quite a few people.
Thanks, George. This next question is assigned to you regarding slide number 15. Should derived requirements be created for code added by compiler and therefore test created?
So if you have a derived requirement, it will have to be verified. Derived requirements have to be verified. They can be verified by test or by analysis.
Yeah, George, I think the question was related to specifically the compiler. So if the compiler does some range checking or inserts some other operational functions that are not directly traceable to the source code, would a tester need to add a requirement for that?
Not necessarily, no. It could be done by analysis.
Yeah.
So you could analyze the code and show that the code inserted by the compiler is correct and valid. And our approach when we do testing is we test at the executable image level. We show that all instructions are covered. And as we show the behavior, that the requirements are satisfied with the requirements-based coverage, then we claim that the code inserted by the compiler has been verified.
Okay.
It does not really need a requirement, but it does need analysis.
All right. Next question is also assigned to George. Could you please clarify more on how data and control coupling objectives are satisfied by testing the integrated image without instrumenting the code?
Well, it depends on how you set up your testing environment. You see, many people set up test environment by saying, I will pick up a function, I'll put an environment around it, I'll test the one function. And then they test another function independently. There are other ways of doing this. The way we do it is that we link the image that is to be tested. Let's say it's an operating system. We're verifying an operating system or a board support package. We link the image. Now we can load a test by the side of it, and the test can focus on a specific function, and it can call a specific function. But that function still exists in the integrated image. So we don't change the integrated image. We don't recompile the integrated image differently for testing. The code that flies is the code that is tested. And the tests are loaded, as it were, by the side of the code. And then we, from the linker, we know where all the entry points are, so we can call any function and we can observe the effects from the side, as it were, without changing the integrated image. We also do that for coverage. We measure coverage for level A, that is. For level A, we measure coverage without instrumenting the code, without changing the image.
Thanks, George. I have a question here. It's about the FAA. How does the FAA address use of pseudocode and comments when applicants attempt to use them as low-level requirements?
So pseudocode in the past has been used by some people to say, hey, these are my low-level requirements, because the low-level requirements are those requirements which are low enough that you can write code from. So people might say, well, I'll write some pseudocode, and then I can derive the code from that. Therefore, these are my low-level requirements. And clearly, that is not a good way of working. Because when you write your pseudocode, you've used that pseudocode to express the intended behavior, i.e. behavior like a requirement, and the pseudocode also provides a specification for the code. So it's like the implementation. So now you have one representation which expresses both behavior and implementation, and because it does it together, we prefer there to be a separation. So we don't like pseudocode at all. It has no real value anymore, and the new document, the DO178C, talks in terms of low-level requirements. It doesn't talk in terms of pseudocode.
Yeah, I think, George, just Joe, expand on that comment a little bit. I think the metric here, at least by the FAA standard, will be that, and DERs look at it, is that do you have a requirement to which you can show me you've tested the behavior of this implementation? And if you don't have a requirement that you're testing to, then you just can't say the pseudocode is what I'm verifying. I'm taking coverage credit for execution of higher level tests, even though I have this implementation described in pseudocode. So there could be other ways you can define a design that aren't really specified in requirements, and I think that gets into some of the way people have historically certified and specified low-level requirements for a lot of their implementations, is they've tried to avoid having to write these detailed low-level requirements to verify the implementation, and I think that's being made more clear in DO178C.
Thanks, gentlemen. Next question from the audience. With model-based design, do we have to show traceability between the model and the code the model auto-generates?
Yes, but that is normally done automatically. Most code generators provide a mapping between the source, the generated code, and the model itself. So normally that's already done. It's generated automatically by the tool. But yeah, you do need traceability up and down. Otherwise, there's a gap missing.
I think this next question here that I see is for Joe, just a hunch here. To your knowledge, have any projects undertaken certification efforts using multi-core?
There have been some initial projects that have started development of safety critical systems, but there have not, to my knowledge, been any approvals of multi-core implementations. But there are projects that are now undertaking it that we are involved in.
Okay. Next question from the audience. Are low-level requirements essentially designed? What are examples of bidirectional traceability? Comments and code permitted to support bidirectionality.
So traceability can be done in low-level requirements are viewed by some people as design. The design is a difficult word because what it is really a refinement. It's making, as we refine the requirements going down, we're making design decisions. So these are design decisions, but they're still requirements in low-level requirements when they express the intended behavior. Now, we need to establish traceability all the way, and traceability are basically links between artifacts. You don't have to trace a line of code to a specific requirement or requirements to a specific set of lines of code. But you have to link close enough that you can understand how this requirement is implemented or if this requirement is actually in the implemented in the code. Because at some point we will be reviewing the code against the low-level requirements. So it may be appropriate to have requirements at the function level and then just point into the function code, and providing you can understand from the code and you understand that the requirements are actually satisfied and the code doesn't implement anything beyond what's in the requirements, then that traceability is enough. It has to be bidirectional so that you can, if you have a test, you can say what function is this testing and what requirement is this verifying. And from the requirement, you have to be able to point back down and say which test implements this, verifies this requirement. So you do need bidirectional traceability.
Okay. Thank you. Next question that I have here. Can you elaborate on how DO178C expands on the concept of source to object traceability?
Yes, it's a difficult one because it's the D178B specifically asks for additional code inserted by the compiler. Now, you don't have to. What people used to do in the olden days is look at the source code and look at the assembly listing and then cross-check everything by hand. That's not a requirement. What is a requirement is that if there is an extra behavior inserted by the compiler, that has to be identified. Now, the sort of behavior, so the traceability between source and object code is only for the additional behavior. Now, as an example, and some of these are tricky, when you look at the source code for a while loop, you think at the source code there's a while loop, there's one condition at the top, so I'm expecting one condition in my object code. Very often, because of compiler optimization reasons, the compiler generates two conditionals, one of which says, shall I enter the loop? And the second condition, which says, shall I repeat the loop? It's typically a better use of registers when you do it that way. What we found occasionally, though, is that when we measure coverage at the machine code level, one of those instructions is not covered. At the source code level, we can't see, we can't tell. When the compiler optimization is switched on, extra instructions have been added, and there is an extra instruction there which may not be covered by our tests. For level A software, we identify that and we explain this has been inserted by the compiler, this is correct code, and we're done with that analysis. It's very simple, very easy, but we do identify it. And there's many other cases like that, especially when you start using C++.
All right, thanks, George. Let me get to another question here from the audience. We only have time for a couple more. We're going to end this in a few minutes. We went a little bit over because we had great questions. How do you prove code coverage with a class instantiated as several objects?
So typically, we would write a set of tests for the class itself. And then we would instantiate the test using that class to make sure that, the code, all the methods of that class are covered. It also means, though, whenever you have the object, that each of those objects will have, or the object may have a what we call a dispatch table, basically a set of pointers to the functions which implement the methods. And we show through our testing that all the elements of the dispatch tables, all the pertinent elements of the dispatch tables have been covered during our requirement-based tests. So we do write more tests for the classes, and we do more analysis and testing for the objects. That's why I mentioned before, you know, object-oriented development might reduce the total amount of code, but what we found is the amount of testing might not be reduced. In actual fact, it might be increased. We don't have specific metrics at the moment, but we are going through and measuring that.
Okay. Next question from the audience. Is verification of configuration required at load time? Is there a separation between requirements at loader system startup versus going operation of software? After this, we'll have time for just one more question. George or Mark?
Can you repeat the question?
They're asking about the verification of configuration required at load time. And, yeah, so certainly if you have configuration parameters that impact the behavior of the runtime application, then you know, certainly that will be the instantiation at startup may indeed be different than that at runtime. So there could be a configuration parameter that might be invoked at runtime that changes the behavior, and there also may be a set of parameters at configuration parameters at load time that may instantiate a given behavior. In both those cases, you would need separate verification activities of the usage of that configuration setting. And George did elaborate on some of that and the complexities of how to verify configuration parameters during this presentation.
Yes, in fact, so for some of these verification configuration data, what we've done in the past, and Joe's familiar with this, we've developed tools which do the translation, and these are qualified development tools, which means that providing you, you can verify and trust the data going into your configuration settings, then the translation of those settings into the binary image which is then loaded for your configuration vector, that can now be trusted because that's a qualified development tool. It's hard work to do this, but it's certainly worthwhile if that tool is going to be used a lot.
Okay, this is the very last question. What are acceptable uses of dynamic memory allocation, startup versus ongoing operation? Are examples of deterministic memory allocation?
Typically, it's not allowed. Normally, for all the systems we've seen, you can start doing dynamic memory allocation during system startup. As soon as system startup is complete and the system becomes operational, then dynamic memory allocation is switched off. If you want dynamic memory management after that, then people typically arrange smaller memory pools. Typically, objects of the same size are then pooled and managed much more efficiently. But what we don't want is something like dynamic heap, where the allocation in the dynamic heap is easy, but the deallocation and then reallocation is really problematic.
Well, that brings us right up to our time limit for today, actually beyond our time limit. Great questions that we had and great presenters, and I would like to thank George and Joe for speaking today and Wind River and Vericel for sponsoring the event. This eCast will be posted online today, and an audio-only podcast version will also be available. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future webcasts with OpenSystems.